began, we covered the first couple of verses. It began by moving into a bit of a prophecy, okay? It begins letting them know and letting them see some things that's going to take place in their future. The prophecy that it's making a reference to is what we would refer to as the time of tribulation. The Bible refers to it as the 70th week of Daniel. All right, and so he lets them know that what's going to take place, because remember, he's been really chewing out these priests and Levites because they've not been what they ought to be. They've been wicked and they've done evil things. They've not upheld the office the way they should uphold the office. And so what happens is he lets them know that there's going to be a day where God's going to judge all of that. And so he just moves them immediately into some prophecy and lets them know about that 70th week of Daniel and make sure they understand that God was going to refine them and cleanse them and do all of those things that he's going to do during that time. Because the 70th week of Daniel, or the tribulation period, is a week of years, seven years, that is designed for the purpose of purging Israel so that it's ready to move into the kingdom, all right? I'm going to share something with you. I don't know if you've ever thought about this or not, because when we pick up in verse 3, we're actually going to pick up in the millennial kingdom, all right? And so he's talking about the fact that tribulation period, having refined and removed all the wicked priests and having cleansed the holy priests, he's going to use them to offer up sacrifices during the millennial. So there's two things I'm going to share with you tonight that I don't know if you've really given any thought to. Number one, did you know? And I think most of the guys that I hang with and know, believe and agree with this, but only saved individuals are going to enter into that millennial kingdom. The people that are left over from the time of tribulation, you're going to have saved Israel, all right? He's going to purge out all the wickedness out of Israel. All of those who are going to rebel, all of those who want nothing to do with God are going to be killed off during that time. And only ones that will be alive and the only ones that will enter into that millennial kingdom will be saved Israel. Gentile nations, those that are not Jews, only ones that will be entering into the millennial kingdom will be those nations who have followed Christ and chosen to accept him. All the others, when he comes, those nations are going to turn against him, are going to battle against him, and what you'll find is he'll destroy all of them. So all the people that enter into that 1,000 years, that millennial kingdom, will be saved individuals. Now, I say that, but keep this in mind. During that 1,000 years, you have to remember that those people then are going to have children. There'll be births during that time. And so those who are born during that time, keep in mind that they'll be forced to follow after all the things that God institutes, all the things that Christ institutes. That's why we're told he rules with a rod of iron, because he has individuals that haven't necessarily trusted him, but will be obedient unto him. And those who choose to rebel, he'll deal with them in such a fashion as with a rod of iron, all right? So those are the people that are being born during that time. And I had someone even ask me this question at one time. They said, well, you know, what's the deal here? You've got going into this 1,000 years. I mean, if it's most all saved people, what's at the end of that 1,000 years when Satan is released from this pit and is given a season to gather folks up and to try to get them to rebel and turn against Christ? Where did they come from? Well, they were born during that time. I want you to imagine for just a second. We talked about this in our class last Monday night. But imagine for a second. You realize from the days of Noah with 8 people until 1,000 years later, starting with only 8 people, you realize there was somewhere in the neighborhood. What was the number we came up with? Was it 50 or 500 million? 500 million, wasn't it? From the 8 to 1,000 years later was like 500 million, okay? Now imagine, I have no idea how many people are going to go into the millennial. I have no way of knowing that. But here's what I do know, is you're going to have 1,000 years of giving birth. So if 1,000 years produce 500 million only from 8 people, I don't know the number that's going to go in the millennial, but that's going to put a pretty good sized number at the end for a lot of different reasons, because the millennial kingdom, keep in mind, It says that the old and the young, you know, that the young will live to be old. There'll be nobody dying young. There's not going to be this disease factor that's going to be an issue. We'll basically die at an old age from just being old. And what will happen is we'll be lively and fruitful and all those kind of things up until the time we die, until the time they die, the people that have entered into that period. And so what happens is they've got a long life. They're not going to be any infant deaths. So in addition to the increase that we would normally expect, during that time, you can increase that, all right, because there's not going to be those childhood deaths. So it's just interesting to me. You're going to have an awful lot of people at the end of that millennial kingdom who have, you know, lived the, you know, through that day and through that time that are now in a position to where now they're going to have to make a decision, all right? So it's not just the people that enter into the millennial kingdom, because those people are saved and they're eternally saved. So you have the people that are born during that time that something has to be done with and something has to go on. Now, I said all of that because when we're looking at this picture, I want to bring up this second picture. He says in verse 3, "And he shall sit as a refiner and a purifier of silver. He shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver." Now, listen to this. "That they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness." Now, the reason he says that is because, keep in mind, that 70th week of Daniel is that time of purging. That is that time where he purges out all the wicked priests, all the wicked Israel, and salvages or redeems the nation Israel, commemorating Jesus Christ and loving Jesus Christ. They enter into this kingdom, and when they do, in the 1,000 years... the sacrifices are restored. They start sacrificing again. And that's always been a puzzling thing for me, because if we're not careful, we look at the sacrifices as we looked at the sacrifices in the Old Testament. Because when we look at the sacrifices in the Old Testament, the purpose in those sacrifices was because these people are sinners, and the lamb that they sacrificed, for example, would cover their sins. We understand that it was a picture of the coming Jesus Christ, and when Jesus Christ died, put an end to those sacrifices, because he ultimately becomes that sacrifice. In the millennial kingdom, they will make sacrifices, but for a different reason entirely. They won't be doing so in looking to have their sins satisfied. That's been done through Jesus Christ, but they do so in commemoration of what he has done. It's a commemorative thing, much like us, all right? When we talk about, you know, today he gives us, as a church, he gives us two ordinances. Both of those ordinances are commemorative. I am not baptized in order to be saved. I do not observe the Lord's Supper in order to be saved. I do so commemorating what Jesus Christ did for me, all right? It's to commemorate the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's also to commemorate what took place in my own life through the blood of Jesus Christ. He died for my sins, therefore I die to the old self and I arise in a newness of life. All right? It's all commemorative. Everything about the picture of baptism says this is what Christ did for me. It's not to go back and relive it. It's not because I'm looking for a day when that actually takes place somewhere in the future. It's already been done, and it's a commemorative thing. Lord's Supper, same thing. All right. When we partake of that that unleavened bread, we understand and realize it represents the suffering of Jesus Christ. His not broken bones, but just the fact of his body being bruised and beaten and all those kinds of things. It's understanding the suffering that on his behalf. And then we drink the little cup of grape juice, recognizing the blood of Jesus Christ that was shed on our behalf and cleanses us. We get all of that. It's not because we're looking for that to happen in some future event so that we might be saved. It's a commemorative thing to say we know what took place and we recognize that. The sacrifices that take place in that millennial kingdom will be sacrifices that are commemorative, looking back and recognizing what Jesus Christ did for them that allowed them to be there. You know, part of the picture for that is because Israel rejected him. As a nation, Israel rejected him. This is not our Messiah. This is not, you know, this is not who God said would come. He is not the one we've been looking for. And then they get to this point and they get to this time and they realize, oh, yes, he is. this is the Christ, this is the Messiah. And, you know, in commemoration of the fact that, you know what, we have as a nation, Israel, as a nation, we haven't recognized him as our Messiah for these whatever years, 2,000 plus years. We haven't recognized him as our Messiah, and now it's time that we make sure that we commemorate what he did, because we now recognize, we now see as a nation and as a people, we now see our salvation is because of what he did on the cross. So it takes us back and helps them to see and to commemorate what Christ did for them. Because quite frankly, they had rejected that, and now they come to this place and it's like, oh man, I get it. I get it. That's who he is. He's our Messiah. And they trust him. And so only those who have come into the millennial kingdom, those priests who have been purged and cleansed, and now you have only the holy ones, the ones who have given their heart and life to him, able then, because of their life, because of who they are, because of the acceptance of him, they're now able to make those sacrifices in commemoration of what Jesus Christ has done for them. All right? A thought? Question? I know sometimes that kind of stuff's confusing. And it is a battle. It's hard to kind of get a grip on some of those things. All right? Verse 4 says, then, I always like when he goes, then. It tells me, okay, after this is done, after that, then, he says, shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto the Lord as in the days of old and as in former years? I am a history guy. How many other people here are kind of history buffs? Yeah, I like history. I like the history of the United States. I like the history of the world. I like the Old Testament, because honestly, I like to see Israel's progression, and I enjoy that. Some people don't. I do. And like I said, I even enjoy the history of the United States. I like knowing where we came from. I like the history of the Baptist Church. I like knowing where we came from. I like knowing where all that kind of works in and plays out. I'm into that stuff. I enjoy it. Now, I say that because that's a very biblical notion, because we are supposed to look back and we are supposed to remember and we are supposed to use that to help us be what we need to be. That's why he gives us baptism. That's why he gives us the Lord's Supper. Call to our memory the things that took place. I mean, that's the point and that's the purpose. That's why we have his holy word. We can look back and we see how he's worked and how he's done through the history of time and how he's moved in the nation Israel and how he moves in our life. And it's like, okay, I get it. And so it reveals a lot of those things. Now, he tells them that by these obedient servants being able to move in, there is a rejoicing, there is a newness, there is a revival in the nation of Israel during that time, because he wants them to know, listen, you're going to move into a place where you're going to love the things of God. Man, the things of God are going to be awesome to you. You're going to look forward to it. You're going to rejoice about it once again. Now, you'll understand some of that better. We probably won't get there tonight, but on down towards the end of this chapter, where he talks about, you know, the fact that they've decided things of God really aren't all that worth rejoicing over. He said there's going to come a time where it's going to be just like it used to be, because there have been days of old where these things were good. Let me give you some examples of that. 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 10. This is back in the days of Solomon. They built the temple. They had offered up the sacrifices. Man, it was just an exciting day. Remember, the temple that Solomon built was the first temple they'd ever had. Prior to that, they had a tabernacle. They could move from here to there and wherever. And now they've got a stationary place. They've got the temple. It's built, and Solomon spared no expenses. Phenomenal temple. All right, beautiful beyond our wildest imaginations. And this is what he says. And on the 23rd day of the 7th month, this is what he says. He sent the people away into their tents. I love this next line. Glad and merry in heart for the goodness that the Lord had shown unto David and to Solomon and to Israel, his people. They went away glad. They went away just rejoicing and merry in their heart for the goodness of the Lord. There are days, and you guys will probably testify to this, there are days when, man, you're just rejoicing in your heart. It's good because you know what God's done for you. I mean, it's just overwhelming. But you have to admit there are other days where it's like, God, where are you? you know, we all kind of experience some of that. We all kind of go through that. I'm going to be real honest with you. As a pastor, I go through that on Sundays quite often. On Sundays, every Sunday I'm so excited and pumped and can't hardly stand it. I can't wait to get here. I can't wait to do the things I do. I can't wait to preach. And I come in so excited. And depending upon what takes place through the course of the day dictates whether or not I go home that excited, you know? Because what happens is I may come and other people are glad to be here and excited to be here and things are going great and people are excited and great things happen and people are looking for the Lord to move in their hearts and in their lives. We have a great service and people are glad that they came and people are excited to be here and we go home and everything's exciting. Those are the days I long for. Those are the days I like. I love those days. But there's also those days, realistically, where I come and anything and everything can happen, whether it be somebody fussing at me about something, because Sunday's a prime day to do that. They don't see me all week, and they look at me on Sunday. Oh, this is a good time to fuss about this. There's Barry. I can tell him now. And so I get an earful. And there's also the possibility that when I preach, that honestly, I feel like I flopped. You know, I just didn't fall the way I wanted it to fall. Things didn't seem to go as they should have went. Maybe my heart's not in it. Maybe the people's heart's not in it. Who knows? We all can be guilty of that. Every one of us have a hand and a part in those things. Maybe, you know, maybe some catastrophe happened. Maybe, some couple of people got in an argument and it just kind of spoiled the day. Maybe, you know, maybe it was one of those days where it just seemed like nothing went right. And you go home going, oh, man, worked so hard all this week for today. You know, and then that's the way it went. Those things happen. But you ponder and you look back on the good days. You know, and those are the days that are exciting. I mean, I look back in my life and I think about certain times. I look back at the revival meeting that I was saved at. And it was at Salem Baptist Church, Russell Springs, Kentucky. I forget the exact number that was saved during the course of that revival, but for some reason the number 17 stands out in my head. But it was a good number. It was a big number. And my dad was preaching that revival. A lot of that revival, I know some of the other folks that got saved in the exact same revival. And I know, including myself, I know of three that were called into the ministry that have pastored churches out of that one revival. And I look back in my mind and I think, man, that was a good day. That was a good time. Lord blessed. Lord did great things. How many people have come to know Jesus Christ since then just through the ministry of those 17 people? And, you know, I think about that sometimes. It got me really pondering that the other day, and I began to look at some of the folks that have come to Christ during the time that I've been at the Hilltop Baptist Church. The 35 years I've been here, we've baptized around 500. We've seen a minimum of 1,000 saved. We have had, you know, we've helped to start, well, we didn't help to start, we did start three churches who lead people to the Lord all the time, who, one of which has started a church as well. And the list kind of goes on. We've helped start another 20 plus churches just in the States. And, you know, we've supported a grand total of somewhere in the neighborhood of about 50 missionaries over the course of time that have been out and about. And I stop and I think about some of that and I think, man, how incredible of what has taken place. And God used me to be a part of that. A little 12-year-old boy who trusted Jesus Christ at a little revival down in Russell Springs, Kentucky. And you stop and think about how God uses those things. And I got to tell you, that excites me. And I think about what God can continue to do and what he's blessed and what he's done. And I think, man. You know, what did I ever do to deserve that? Nothing, zilch, zero. God loved me, God cared for me, saved me, and allowed me to be in on it. Amen. How incredible is that? Not only that, but you begin thinking about other things. I remember a particular revival again. It's kind of funny the way God does things. In particular revival, again, down in Russell Springs, Kentucky. It was First Baptist Russell Springs. And I was just talking to Jody the other day. We was talking about this, and he shared some things that I didn't even realize. But in that revival meeting, on that particular Wednesday night, it was the Wednesday night, if I remember right, of that revival, I got so sick I didn't think I was even going to be able to go. And I'm like, Jody, I am sick, beyond sick. I mean, I was lightheaded. I felt like I was going to fall over. I was sick, sick, sick. I kind of just kind of sat in the back, a little room back behind the stage, kind of off to the side for a while they were starting the church, because I was just sitting back there thinking I was going to throw up at any moment. I was sick. I had given them my outline, and I sent word to them. I said, listen, tell them I can't preach that sermon. I just can't. I can't focus on it. I can't think about it. I just can't. I'm going to have to just do some little simple something. And I did. I got up there and I just preached a little simple something. And I'm going to tell you now, there's no way that by my standards or by what I think is good, there's no way I did well at all with that sermon. I was out of the picture. What happened with that sermon was completely and totally 100%, 1,000% God. I don't honestly even remember much of what I said. That night, 10 people got saved. That night, 10 people. The next morning, I went to the hospital and spent the day in the hospital getting fluids, and come to find out I had strep, and apparently I had it pretty bad. And I mean, I spent the day in the hospital getting fluids along with, I guess, antibiotics or whatever it is they give you. But I know I was wired up for about 6 hours. And so I was sick. Jody said that from that revival, he said he estimated they had like 27, 28 people saved from that revival. And it all stemmed from a night where God got me out of the way so that he could do something. And I think, but he let me do it. You know what I'm saying? He let me be a part of it. But he made sure that I knew had nothing to do with me. And I think that is so awesome when God does that. And I look back at that and I think, God, what can't you do? I mean, you can do anything with anybody. You can accomplish anything you want to accomplish. And that is so overwhelming to me. So he tells them, remember what it was like. Remember what you, if you weren't there, remember the reading. Remember the things that took place. Remember what Grandpa taught you. Remember what Dad said to you about how incredible it was when Solomon's temple was built and they came and rejoiced and people went home glad and merry. How incredible. There's no reason why it shouldn't be like that all the time. But he's saying there's going to come a day it's even better than that. And he shared, you might want to share even a few more. I just dug some up that I thought was kind of interesting. The people that reacted after the sacrifices in the day of Hezekiah. 2 Chronicles 30:26 says this. So there was great joy in Jerusalem. For since the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, there was not like in Jerusalem. He's saying this was the best since the time that Solomon sent him home glad and merry. All right. So in Hezekiah, you see another picture of that. Under King Josiah, 2 Chronicles 35:18, just the whole thing. And there was no Passover like to that kept in Israel from the day of Samuel the prophet. Neither did all the kings of Israel keep such a Passover as Josiah kept, and the priests and the Levites and all Judah and Israel that were present and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. There was never a Passover like that one. And saying that one, there was so much celebrating because of what God had done. One last one just to throw at you. He says in Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse 17, and this is close to this time of Malachi, because this is something that had taken place probably in the neighborhood of 12 to 15 years prior to this. And it says in Nehemiah 8:17, and all the congregation of them that were come again out of the captivity made booths. Remember talking about that? Sat under the booths, for since the day of Joshua the son of Nun, under the day had not the children of Israel done so. And there was great gladness. Now, said all that to say, when you look back at such a time, and that's what he tells them to do, he says, look back, notice, remember those times, remember all that took place, and he's saying, there's going to come a time where there's going to be gladness like you can't imagine. And when you think about this 1,000 years, a time where now the Messiah reigns, Israel's following him. You have only saved Israel. You have only saved individuals. And they come together and they're praising and glorifying Christ, who is sitting on the throne and reigning with them. I got to tell you, I can't imagine how incredible the time must be. And as they're offering up those sacrifices, they're looking at the very Christ that these sacrifices represent. And as they offer them up, it's a matter of, we're offering this up to you in commemoration of what you have done and what you have accomplished. Wow. I mean, to have Christ right there present and then to offer these things right at his feet. How incredible would that be? And he's saying that is what's going to come. So he's letting them know that, listen, the wickedness and how evil they had been as priests and what they were doing, he said, that don't cut it. Because God has bigger plans for Israel than to be led by wicked priests. All right? Then in verse 5, all right? Then in verse 5, he says this. He says, and I will come near to you to judgment. He backs up a little bit and he says, and I will be swift witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, against false swearers, and against those that oppress the hireling and his wage, the widow, the fatherless, and that turn aside the stranger from his right and fear not me, saith the Lord of hosts. Now, understand that much of what he's going to do, he says he's going to rule with a rod of iron, even during that time of the millennial kingdom. And so what we're going to find is during that time, he's going to exact judgment upon folks. And you think, again, we're going to go back to that. Well, who is this judgment for? Well, it's people that's going to be born into the time. There'll be people born, and these are folks that some of them might choose to rebel, and he won't tolerate it. He won't tolerate it. You know, here's the problem today. The problem today is not the rebellion. The problem today is that there's no judgment against the rebellion. That's the dilemma. It's that nobody stops it. It's that it's allowed to reign. It's allowed to continue. It's allowed to flourish. And the more that flourishes, the more the rebellion can creep in behind it. There's nobody that sets the standard. Nobody that says, this is the way it's going to be. There's not a standard. There's nothing. God, when he is ruling, when Christ is ruling in the millennial kingdom, it's not that people won't rebel, and it's not that people won't be disobedient. It's that you have a king that won't tolerate it and will judge it and will deal with it immediately. Now keep this in mind, because we also know this, that during that time of the kingdom, Satan is bound in a pit. He's not an influence on the people. He's not there to, you know, to influence them and to deal with them in any way whatsoever. Understand, though, that they will have the old sinful flesh. All right? They're born, and they're not born perfect. And so there's still a decision to be made on those people's part. That decision will be made even through that course of time. There'll be some of them that will not necessarily say, I like the idea of Jesus Christ judging over me. I like him being my king. There's some of those that are not going to like that. They're going to rebel about it. So understand and know that that's kind of the way that's going to be. Romans 11:25 says this, for I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part has happened to Israel under the fullness of the Gentiles become in. All right? Israel's going to be blind until the end of the Gentile reign. All right? And by the way, the Gentiles basically reign until the coming of Jesus Christ. You know when the Gentiles essentially started reigning? Don't say it, Bo. You know when the Gentiles basically started reigning? Was when they went into captivity in Babylon. Up until that time, Israel had kings. All right? But then when they were taken into captivity, they didn't have another king. They didn't have another king. Still don't have a king, won't have a king until Jesus Christ is set on the throne as king. All right? Now, the Gentiles have ruled them basically the entire time. I know they have their own nation today. I get it. But my point is, it's still the time of the Gentiles, because God hasn't yet turned his attention to the Jews to focus on the Jews. And even during the tribulation time, when he does focus on them, keep in mind, they have put their trust in the Antichrist. All right? When Christ returns, he destroys that Gentile rule, and he takes over as king, and Israel reigns with him. That's when the fullness of the Gentiles ends. Now, with that having been said, that brings us to this passage that I just read to you. And then he says, and so all Israel shall be saved as it is written. And they will. All that remains at the time of tribulation are saved individuals. There shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins. So it's Jesus Christ who comes in at that moment. We're following you. You're our Lord. You're our King. You're our Messiah. And they trust him and follow him. And he will reign and use them to reign. All right? So you find all that purging that we already talked about. Now, I don't want you to notice the list of sins he talks about there. Sorcerers, adulterers, liars, oppressors of widows, oppressors of orphans. That's the way that reads. Those that mistreat others and those who do not fear God. Apparently, these were a real problem that Israel was facing in Malachi's day. So he drew attention to those sins. All right? There's always a reason when somebody draws attention to sins. They draw attention to the ones that are the problem, all right? In our day and time, you know, like it or not, it just always jumps out. When we talk about horrible things that take place in our nation, some of the things that automatically just kind of leap out of my mouth is just typically because folks have really embraced homosexuality. That becomes one we talk about, okay? Because people have embraced abortion, of course, we're going to mention that. It is a sense of our day. It's not as apt for me to talk about sorcery, or it's not as apt to talk about witchcraft, because we don't see it so prevalent in our faces. And so if I were in Haiti, that might be a different story. And maybe those would be the things that would leap out. But I'm just saying, when he talks about these particular sins, it makes me think that when Malachi is mentioning these sins, it's because in the day that he's living in, that's probably the sins they're dealing with. That's probably the stuff that's right in front of their face. And when we're talking about these priests, and he's talking about how they've turned wicked and they've turned evil, they've done some things they ought not to do, I think this is his way of letting us know, listen, this is how wicked they had become. They've gotten caught up in this stuff, and it's awful. They're mistreating the widows. They're mistreating the orphans. What does James say about widows and orphans? True religion is what? Help me out. Yes, the fatherless, but yes, that's it. All right? So true religion pays attention to those widows, pays attention to those that are fatherless, and cares for them, all right, because they need someone to love them and someone to care for them. This is a picture of where our heart is, all right? And he's saying, guys, in his day, the priests are at a place where they got a cold heart. You know, they've turned from Christ. They've turned from the things of God. They're nowhere near what God would have them to be, and not serving as God would have them to serve. So he was drawing attention to their sins. So if they're sitting there and he's calling these things out, what they're doing is they're sitting there, you know, okay, God's going to judge me because I am a whatever. And God's going to judge that. You know, and that's the intent. That's the intent. When people read Scripture, God's going to single out those sins in our life. Do you ever notice how he does that? I don't care. I don't care if you're preaching on tithing. You know, if there's sin in my life and God's going to deal with it, I'm going to hear that somewhere in that message. You know, I'm just going to hear it. God convicts me of it. You know, you may never mention it, may never say anything about it, but for some reason I feel like, man, you have preached right to me because, yeah, I really am a liar. I just don't. You know, it's just the way it works sometimes. I've had people, it's like the old Andy Griffith. You remember the old Andy Griffith episode where Bernie fell asleep? He slept during the entire service, and the guy that was preached such a nothing message about how we ought to just relax. And as they walked out, you know, Bernie shakes his hands. Oh, that was a great message. I mean, we can't get too much of that preaching on sin, you know. And Andy smacks him. He didn't preach on sin, you know. I feel that way sometimes. You know, I've had people walk out and say, oh boy, pastor, that just really dealt with my heart, you know, and mention things that I don't remember ever even talking about in the message. So it's just the way it works. All right. In verse 6, he says this. He says, for I am the Lord, I change not, therefore you sons of Jacob are not consumed. All right. I think this is really important because he says, I'm the Lord, I change not, therefore you sons of Jacob are not consumed. He said, I made a covenant with Abraham. I renewed that covenant with Isaac. I renewed that covenant with Jacob. And so all of you who are a product of Jacob, he said, the only reason I have not wiped you out, taken you off the face of the earth, because I don't change. I make a covenant, I keep my covenant. And otherwise, because of your disobedience, because of where you've come and because of what you're doing, I'd have had to just kill you off. I'd have had to just consume you. I'd have had to taken you out of the picture. But I'm a God that doesn't change. I made a covenant, and I'm going to keep my covenant. And the only reason that you are a nation, the only reason you still exist, the only reason you are where you are, and the only reason you have these promises, and the only reason I dwell among your people, because I made a covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I don't change. I don't take it back. And he makes sure they understand that. You are not the reason. You know, I when I was not very old, I'm trying to think how old I was when I came to pastor. 35 years ago, around, what was I, 27? Does that sound right? 27 years old. And I had only been here a very, very short while. And a guy visited that knew my dad. And my dad had just passed away. He died just a couple of years after I came here. And he came and he shook my hand and he said, you know, I just came because I loved your dad. That's exciting, and I appreciate that. I love my dad, too. But in some ways, it was like, that was his way of also saying it had nothing to do with you. You know what I'm saying? In my mind, it was like, I came because of your dad, not because of you. I kind of feel this way with Israel. God is letting them know, listen, I'm not entered into a covenant with disobedient people. I enter into a covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And if it wasn't for them, I'd have already consumed you. Because you have nothing to do with my grace, what I care for and what I love. It's all about the fact that I made a covenant with them. So boy, I'm telling you, he just really laid it out to them. He said, you would have been consumed had it not been for the fact that I'm not a changing God. All right? And then in verse 7, he takes it just one more step. And in verse 7, he says, even from the days of your father, you are gone away from mine ordinances and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I'll return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. But ye said, wherein shall we return? You're going to get into a little period now for the rest of this chapter where God offers up questions for them. It's like he's saying, I know what you're going to say. And then he answers it. All right? He doesn't wait for them to get the question. He says, here's your question. Here's your answer, you know. And you're going to see the rest of this chapter, he does just that with them. And so if they're going to be blessed with the promises of this covenant, the key is they needed to get their life right. They needed to repent. Something needed to change in their life. And he said, if you'll turn back to me, I'll turn to you. But right now, I'm in a notion that I'd just soon consume you, all right? But I'm not going to because I have a covenant with Abraham, but that's what I'd like to do. That's my intent. If you don't change, if you don't do something different. And it's funny because I when I look at this, I almost see some, I don't know, call it sarcasm or what the word might be. I'm not really sure. But he says this. He says, return unto me, I'll return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. But ye say, or you said, wherein shall we return? It's one of those pictures that it's kind of like saying, what have we done wrong? What have I done wrong? I don't get it. What have we done wrong? What is it that you expect of us? Everybody here that has had children understand and have heard a statement very much akin to this at some point in time. I mean, when we think about our children, if we confront them about something that they've done wrong, some failure to do something, or express some, I don't know, what is disdain the right word? About, you know, something that they didn't like, or that they, you know, had these awful, or confronted with something in such a way that they indicated by, I don't know, sarcasm. Maybe they rolled their eyes. Maybe they sighed. You know what I'm saying? And then they, you know, and they give that, what did I do? What did I do? And then we answer, you know what you did. This is kind of that picture. It's one of those deals where, you know, God had given them commands. He had given them laws. He had given them orders. They knew what they were supposed to do. It wasn't a question. And it's like they're rolling their eyes going, okay, what did we do wrong? What do you want me to do? I mean, what do you want me to do about it? And, you know, I kind of picture that because I see me doing that when I was a teenager. I really see my kids doing that, you know. And I'm going to laugh at them when their kids do it to them. But, you know, it's that whole picture about, you know, it's just an attitude. And he catches them in this attitude, and he kind of approaches them with that same question that he knows they're going to ask. And they knew what they had done, and they knew what they needed to do. And then he breaks it down. He starts with, you know, you're going to say, what do we do now? And then he begins to break it down with more questions. In verse 8, okay, let's break it down. Will a man rob God? Yet you've robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. I love the way he does this. He gives the question. He gives the answer, and then he tells them what their question's going to be again, and then he gives them the answer. He doesn't give them an opportunity to say it. He just says, this is what I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, where'd we rob you? Well, you robbed me in tithes and offerings. Now, when he looks at this, he just challenges them on most every turn. So he begins with, will a man rob God? Now, keep in mind, in order to really get a good grip on this, we've got to remember who he's addressing. Lost people? Yes, sir. He's not addressing lost people. He's addressing his nation, his people. And when we look at this even today, we have to understand he's not talking about a lost world. He's not even talking to them about a Gentile world. He's talking to them about national Israel. But even more specifically, remember, he is still talking to these priests. He is still talking to the spiritual leaders of the people. And he says, listen, you've robbed God. And they're going, how did we rob God? And he says, you, talking to the spiritual leaders, you've robbed God in your tithes and offerings. Now, the law is really clear about the fact that they were to give their tithes and offerings, very specific about how they would go about it, how they would do it. And for some reason, these priests got the idea they were exempt from it. By the way, you know, I know pastors that think they're exempt from tithing. They think that because they serve the church, and because it's the church's tithes and offerings that pay them, they then are exempt from tithing. And their argument is, well, then what's the difference whether I do that or the church just pays me that much less? That's because if they just paid you that much less, then you'd still have to pay tithe on that. You know, that's why. You're obligated to tithes and offerings. You know, just it doesn't matter where my money comes from. I'm obligated to tithes and offerings just like anybody else would be obligated to tithes and offerings. And just so you know, your pastor tithes, okay, just for the record. But my point being is that in this picture, all right, that was the argument, and that was what was taking place. And he says, by the way, I am your God, and you robbed me. This is my money. It's not even yours. And you just took it. You think that hasn't robbed me? They had clear instructions to give their tithes and offerings. And by the way, in their day, tithes and offerings were bigger than just spiritual things. That was basically their national, that was their taxes for the nation as well. Their tithes and offerings did two things. It paid for all the government stuff, and it paid for the temple and the priests. It paid for all of that because they were joined together. This is a theocracy. God governed Israel. All right, and so the spiritual and the politics were all one and the same. And so, you know, where you had a king, you also had a high priest. And so they worked and merged, and the whole thing worked together. That was the way God governed. And that's the way he'll govern in the millennial, by the way. And so what we have in this picture is that he's saying you've robbed God in these tithes and offerings. But the funny thing is, you know, by doing so, they kind of take it to a different degree. Their livelihood was dependent upon tithes and offerings, and yet they're not teaching the people to do tithes and offerings because they don't do tithes and offerings. They were robbing themselves and not even realizing it. They were hurting their own lives. It was causing many of them not to even be able to do their priestly duties and have to return to the farms and do farming and that kind of thing because they weren't practicing and they weren't preaching and they weren't teaching the things that God told them to preach and God told them to teach. All right? One last thing, and then I'll close out here. Some people argue that tithes and offerings is only an Old Testament principle, and that's nowhere taught in the New Testament. I'm just going to throw this out there at you, all right? I really don't agree with that notion. Luke chapter 11, verse 42 says this. This is Jesus talking to the Pharisees. But woe unto you, Pharisees, And listen to what he says. For ye tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs and pass over judgment and the love of God. And then there's a colon, all right? Which means this is going to have something to do with that as well. And listen to what he says. These ought you to have done and not to leave the other undone. He doesn't say you shouldn't have done that. He's saying you should do that. You did the right thing in doing that. But you can't do that at the expense of the other things that are important to do. You can't just pick and choose what you want to do and let everything else go. He's saying those things you ought to do and also these things. So, you know, it's important that we understand. It's like saying that as we have to be, you know, God is a holy God and God is a just God. But God's also a loving God, okay? You really don't want one without the other. If he's a just God, we're bound for hell. It's hopeless. But he's a loving God. He sent his only begotten son to die for us so it would satisfy that penalty. I don't want one without the other. All right? So that's the picture. A second verse, just to throw this out there, at you, Matthew 5:20. This is in the Beatitudes. And this is when he's talking about, you know, that whole picture where you've read this, you've heard it said, but I require this. You know, I would say that you need to go a step beyond that. You've heard it said not to commit adultery, but I'm telling you that if you so much as even lust after a woman in your mind, that you've committed adultery. It's that picture. And he says this in verse 20, for I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. We're actually not called just to tithe. We're actually called to do as much as we could possibly do. Actually called to do more. In our church, we have established principles and ways for you to do that. We receive tithes and offerings, and we expect you to go beyond tithes and offerings to help the missionaries or help whatever else is going on. You know, we have first one thing and another. We get it. Our church is a giving church. We've got good people that want and desire and understand those principles. I'm just saying that what they had done was they had put that aside. And they were no longer doing the things that God had said for them to do. And that's just the place where he starts. You robbed God because you took God's money, you know. And you got to get past that mentality that I have a paycheck. This is mine. I'm going to give God 10%. No, you did not. You have God's money in your hand, and God's going to give you 90%. You know, it's a mentality. It's the way we look at it. It's the way we perceive what God would have us to see and what God would have us to do. All right, I'll stop there. All right, went on long enough tonight. We'll get more questions, though. I mean, he really...